This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, this time of year is important because it's our fall membership drive. And Ashley Thornburg and I are going to remind you that listeners are great, but members make it all possible. Ashley even wants to do it from the road. Ashley, where are you right now?
I am joining you from a rest stop just outside of Jamestown. Pulled over here off of a little road trip exploring this great state. And I am enjoying my time a whole lot, and I would be enjoying it even more to know that members are calling in support of great programming. You can join our membership base when you call 800-359-4145 or by giving online at prairiepublic.org. Everything that you hear on Prairie Public, the words, the programs themselves, but even the equipment that makes it all possible is here because of member support. Your generosity gives Prairie Public the resources to open up the airwaves for a whole hour just for a Main Street conversation.
And of course, we hope that you appreciate the extended conversations we have. We touch on news, we talk to the newsmakers, we talk to leaders in North Dakota and the Prairie region. We try to illuminate the human condition through the spoken word, to use elegant words. We sometimes use poetry, storytelling, the arts, of course. We know our listeners appreciate learning things. That's why we try to dig deep in our interviews to find, you know, something that can be interesting and rewarding to hear about. And if you find that's the case, because you're listening right now, after all, give us a call, 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
Those golden nuggets are my favorite part of my job, and especially during this global pandemic, to find something that we can really hone into and bring it to a regional or local focus, and hearing from people who have not just skin in the game, but skin in the game in this region, from our health experts to school officials across the state. We are checking in on a regular basis because, of course, things are changing at unprecedented rates. And you are listening to a show like Main Street and to all the news programming on Prairie Public for that information, because it helps you to stay informed so that you can make the best decisions possible for you and your loved ones. We hope you find this information useful and that you will support it now with a phone call at 1-800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org.
We hope you find Main Street to be a valuable resource for you. We think it's a valuable resource for our state as well, because we cover a wide area. We have transmitters across the state of North Dakota. We go into Northwest Minnesota. We go into a piece of South Dakota. We go into Montana. And of course, all of this infrastructure costs money too. And the people that do what we do. That's why we come to you a couple of times a year to remind you that we are member supported, Prairie Public. And you can be a member supporting this program right now by giving us a call, 1-800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. We'd love to send you a face mask with the Prairie Public logo.
And we also have available at the $15 a month level a one-year digital subscription to the Washington Post. We know you're a news junkie when you listen to a show like Main Street, and you can feed your news habit with the news, with long-form interviews on Main Street, and then add to that a subscription to the Washington Post at just $15 a month. 1-800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org.
Joining us now on Main Street is Kyle Conway. He's an associate professor of communications at the University of Ottawa. He's also a grad of the University of North Dakota before he got his graduate degrees. And he joins us to talk about his new book, 60 Years of Boom and Bust, The Impact of Oil in North Dakota, 1958 and 2018. Two booms we're going to talk about. Kyle, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why did you want to create this book?
When I So I lived in North Dakota. I taught at UND up through about 5 years ago. And when I was teaching at UND, the most fascinating thing that had ever happened close to me was the oil boom. All of my colleagues were studying it and writing about it. In addition to that, my family is from Williston. It's the town that is the one constant in my life. I was an Air Force brat as a kid. It's the place we always went back in the summer to see our grandparents. And to watch those changes was quite spectacular. The book came about because I wanted to understand those changes.
So you are writing a book that has about a subject that's been written about before, particularly by your colleagues at UND. The Digital Press is putting this book out, and it's available, incidentally, to our listeners, free as a download at thedigitalpress.org. So quite a benefit, I guess, to listening, if you will. How would you describe your place in the number of books that have been written about this subject by your colleagues?
Well, the thing that I like about this book is that it gives a greater historical view of oil booms in the western part of North Dakota than any of the other books that have been written. So it starts by republishing a report from 1958. It was called the Williston Report, written by four professors at UND. And it's a report that's now in the public domain. So the Digital Press let me republish that. But then I got to talk to my colleagues in Canada and in the United States and ask them to contribute chapters that address the same themes as the 1958 report. And so this book gives a greater historical overview over a wider range of aspects, so the change in geography, the social impacts, the economic impacts, the political impacts, than any of the other books. The other books are, I mean, there's one on the Balkan written by my former colleague Bill Kerher and his colleague Brett Weber, that's a really fascinating tour of, like a tour book of Western North Dakota during the boom. And in many ways, I think that this complements Bill's book by giving us that historical background.
Well, Kerher and Weber, we did talk to them on our show about their book, and it was sort of the archaeology of the boom, if you will, sifting through what had been brought by people pouring into the state and money pouring into and out of the state. You're a approach as a professor of communications. How does that color how you approach a project like this?
My PhD is in communication arts. Before that, I actually studied literature when I was an undergraduate at UND, and then I studied linguistics when I did my master's degree at York University in Canada. The thing that links all of these is the interdisciplinary nature of communication. If we want to understand how people talk to each other, in particular, how people in Western North Dakota, how longtime residents and newcomers talk to each other, one of the things that it really helps to understand first is the conditions in which the conversation takes place. I mean, it's a different type of conversation if you feel like your home is threatened, your rent is going up, the land that you love is no longer recognizable. If that's the context, then the conversation that you as a longtime resident, say, are going to have with a newcomer is going to look really different than if you're having a conversation in First Lutheran at the Banquet West dinner where you've invited people and they come and they eat with you and you're having a conversation about your family and you're having a conversation about the things that you love. And so this book, the idea was to talk about or to really describe the impact of this changing environment. Eventually, I want to write more about North Dakota and really focus on those conversations that took place during the boom, especially between longtime residents and newcomers. But this sort of sets the ground for that.
So we're talking about two booms, contrasting them. The first took place in the 1950s. The second in the 21st century has recently subsided a bit. The book seems to have a sort of a theme through it. And I even saw this sentence in something I read about the book. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
That is certainly true. When I first found the 1958 report, I found it completely by accident. It's archived on half a trust, and so it's a digital archive. I was looking for information about the 1950s boom because they've archived a lot of, they just archive old documents. And I came across this report, and I was actually riding the bus going to work, and I downloaded the report onto my phone. And the amazing thing about it was, as you read this introduction from 1958, except for the dates, it reads like the most recent boom. And so it was surprisingly current in the concerns that people had about housing or growing populations or the changing geography of the region. And so the thing that really motivated me to want to look at it more was precisely the fact that even though it had been written 60 years before I was reading it, it could have been written a year or two before I read it.
In your preface to the book, I'm going to quote a sentence or two here. It reminds us that we should ask how we know what we think we know, both as we read the 1958 chapters, whose unacknowledged biases the 2018 chapters work to reveal, and as we read those from 2018, whose unacknowledged biases we contemporary readers might be inclined to share. What are these unacknowledged biases that you came across?
So in the 1958 version, there were the professors who wrote this wanted to ask questions about social problems. And they went in presuming that social problems were going to look a certain way. They thought that social problems would be maybe more crime, or there would be public drunkenness, or it would be the types of things that people talked about a lot during the most recent boom. Their approach to talking about that, though, was they wanted to let the people that they were interviewing define what a social problem was for them. And so what they ended up doing, they talked about housing, for instance, and the people that they talked to didn't see any problem with the housing. If you look in the book, in Chapter 9, I reproduced the images from the original, and you'll see that there are these pictures of things that now we'd call man camps.
Yes.
And there are these images of these trailers that really weren't fit for a North Dakota winter.
And shanty shacks.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was the same problem that people had in the most recent boom, too. But the authors of the 1958 boom weren't able to see that in the same way. And so we look at that now, 60 years later, and through our contemporary eyes, it looks like a different type of problem. So another example, the 1958 authors thought that they would find more or higher rates of prostitution. And they didn't find this really at all. And they were surprised. And they said, well, yes, that's not a problem. One of the authors, Nikki Berg-Burren, who teaches at UND, one of the authors of the chapters that echo those themes, is about how maybe what happened was that the 1958 researchers were looking for something specific and didn't look any further once they didn't see it. So they were looking for prostitution, you know, women walking in the streets, and they didn't see that, so they stopped looking. And her argument is a lot of this was probably taking place in a hidden way. And she cites as her evidence for that the evolution of laws about sex trafficking in North Dakota from the 19th century up until now. And she argues that people were making these laws in response to problems that were clearly existing, even if we don't have direct evidence of them having existed 60 years later.
Are these lessons relearned? I mean, did your research indicate that the state referred to the earlier study when gearing up for the Bakken boom? I mean, there had been this research done. Was anybody in the executive branch of government looking at this book and saying, these are things we might want to check on?
I don't know that they were looking at the 1958 report as such. It's actually really hard to get a copy unless you happen to find this archive. I was lucky. There was one paper copy available on Amazon the day that I discovered the archive, and I ordered it right away. And I mean, that's it. Like, I don't know that there are many more copies beyond that. But I know, on the other hand, that lawmakers during the most recent boom and policymakers and residents were thinking about, especially the 1980s boom, which doesn't get addressed in this book much because I just don't have the materials for it. And they were thinking about, you know, there was sort of a hesitancy to create more infrastructure because people remembered paying off infrastructure for 30 years in a down economy. And they were concerned about that again. And I don't blame them. I mean, that's a long time to pay for roads that you stopped needing at the moment you bought them. On the other hand, I think that the more these booms repeat in North Dakota, the more that people become reflexive about what the booms mean. And they're, you know, people are aware that they're reacting in 2009, they're reacting to 1980, you know, the early 1980s.
Yes.
And they know that this is shaping their reaction. And so they can even take into account the relationship that they have with this memory of the 1980s boom. One of the things that was really striking about the 1950s boom is there wasn't a prior boom. People weren't seeing it through the lens of things that had already happened. One of the real differences in 2008 to 2014 was that people were always looking at it through the lens of the booms that they remembered.
Your book includes substantially the 1958 book as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when I was talking to the authors who eventually contributed to the book, they had a lot of things to say, especially about the social change chapter. And so they go into a great deal more depth than the 1958 authors, because frequently to question the things that the authors from the 1950s had done, and then to push that analysis further.
The reason I ask that is because you have a reprint of the 1958 politics chapter, and it says in that prescient chapter more than 50 years ago, essentially it will attempt to do four things: show how oil has caused the formation of new political associations and modified existing ones, describe the impact of oil upon existing units of government, explain the formation and execution of oil policy, and analyze the effects of oil upon the existing political power structure. Oil and politics. Interesting.
Well, that chapter is about 25,000 words long. It is mammoth. And I've read it a dozen times. I've read everything in the book a dozen times. But that chapter in particular is really interesting for its really detailed account of municipal-level politics in the 1950s, in addition to state-level politics. If you want to know how the 1953 and 1954 city elections went in Williston and in Tioga, you can get a blow-by-blow account of the way the politicians were responding to each other. I don't know that that's everyone's cup of tea, but it's a really interesting account just for its level of detail.
Well, it's an issue that has reemerged, relationship between the oil and gas economy and the state's political structure is been under the microscope as well. How did the two booms, and we're not talking about the 80s one here, I remember reporting on that one a long time ago from the eastern edge of the state, but how did the boom in the 50s and the boom that basically just wrapped up a few years ago diminished a bit, how did they affect community life? In the nexus areas, Williston, Watford City, that kind of place?
So, I mean, from what you read in the 1950s chapters is that, and this is one of the main differences, I think, between the 1950s boom and the most recent one. In the 1950s chapters, there's a discussion of churches and community groups and the ways they did or did not integrate newcomers into their communities. And the thing that was really surprising to me, because it's so different from the 2008 to 2014 boom was that in the 1950s, churches, according to this report, were not particularly active in recruiting members from these new communities who were coming in. There were churches that were started because the newcomers belonged to a denomination that wasn't represented in Williston, but the interviews that the researchers did with church leaders, the church leaders would say, well, you know, we worship differently than they do, and they have their place and we have our place, and we're all very happy with that, which I don't doubt. I'm sure they were very happy with that. But in this much more recent boom, churches were very active in reaching out to integrate people into the community. So the example that my favorite example is the Banquet West, that it's a weekly meal in Williston that it takes place at First Lutheran Church, which is where my parents go. It's run by four churches in the community, and it's a place where newcomers and longtime residents and anyone who wanted to come were invited to come and share a meal together. And this shapes community in a very different way, because you have this one-on-one interaction. People become more human to each other. You get to see the people's stories, and you get to make friends, and it puts a human face on newcomers for the longtime residents and longtime residents for the newcomers. And so I think in that sense, the community evolved differently. Of course, there's also the question of size. Williston Williston's been 12 or 13,000 people for most of my life, and now it's, depending on how you count, about 30,000. And so it's suddenly a much bigger place, and, you know, the traffic has increased. And in my mind, Williston, the 13-mile corner is out of town, because every time I drive from Grand Forks to Williston to see my family, I get to the 13-mile corner, and you turn south, and it's nothing until you get into town. You know, that's not the case anymore. It's built up the entire way.
In this project, what surprises did you discover in your research or the people who contributed chapters to your book?
Now that I reflect on it, you know, I in the book, I write that the boom begins in 2008 and it ends in 2014. And that's because I needed to pick some bookends. I mean, it sort of begins before that and it sort of goes on after that. But one of the things that surprised me in the economics chapter from describing the recent boom is that even though oil prices in 2014 dropped below the level where it was profitable to drill a new well, the amount of oil production continued to rise. And I think even in 2018 or so, it was hitting record levels. So even though there was what appeared to be a bust in many ways, I was surprised at the way that production not only was maintained, but increased even during these points where the price of oil fell much, much below the threshold necessary for a profitable well.
Kyle Conway is an associate professor of communication at University of Ottawa. He's also a UND grad, and he's the editor of a new book, 60 Years of Boom and Bust, The Impact of Oil in North Dakota. And you can find that book as a free download at thedigitalpress.org. That's an enterprise of UND, thedigitalpress.org. Kyle, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Coming up on Main Street, Sue Balcom joins us for another episode of Main Street Eats. And of course, we'll remind you, we are member-supported Prairie Public. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The legislature's budget section has approved a plan by the Bank of North Dakota to use $50 million COVID relief money to help businesses pay down existing debt. The money comes from the CARES Act. The $50 million comes from an earlier $200 million allotment for an interest rate buy-down program. That program had to deal with new debt, but Bank of North Dakota President Eric Hardmeyer says he heard from a number of businesses that the issue was debt still on the books. This was approved by the state's Emergency Commission. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson moved for approval.
As we move forward and we get out of this situation we're in, we've got to have viable business community. It is really critical that we keep our businesses rolling, because they are the engine that is going to get this economy on track. It's the businesses that are going to help provide the revenue we need in the state so we can take care of the services that need to be done.
There were two votes against the program. House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jeff Delzer of Underwood objected to the $50 million amount.
I don't know that I have a problem with some of the ideas, but I would have much preferred we were starting this at a lower level, come in later on and see where we are and whether we needed to add to it. And frankly, I think we should have a little more of this money set aside waiting.
The bank will work with local bankers to make the money available. The money will come in the form of grants. And North Dakota's rainy day funds, including the Budget Stabilization Fund and the K-12 Stabilization Fund, took hits in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic as investments lost value. But State Budget Director Joe Morissette says they have recovered. As for the Budget Stabilization Fund,
and so we finished fiscal year 20 with a balance of a little bit over $726.9 million.
Morissette told the legislature's budget section the statutory limit on the fund is based on 15% of the total general fund. He says that limit is $726 million,
$584,000. So we have about $370,000 over that threshold, and so that will be transferred in the month of September into the general fund as interest collections. And now that we are over that threshold, assuming that there is the market value continues to grow over the next 10 months, we would expect that there would be an additional transfer at the end of the biennium into the general fund.
Morissette says the K-12 stabilization fund is at just under $376 million. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Sue Balcom because it's one of our favorite times of the week.
Sue, thanks for joining us. It's time for Main Street Eats.
Ooh, thanks for having me. We know how much I love food, don't we?
We do. And you're in good company because Doug and I also love food.
But first things first, we're in our fall membership drive.
That's right.
So you're gonna make me sing for my supper?
Yeah, it's kind of a thing. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You don't have to sing, Sue.
Oh, come on, I love to sing, but nobody likes to listen.
Oh, there's that. Yeah. Pledge now, yeah. For Ashley and Sue to not break into a duet here.
You know, the great thing about having Sue Balcom, root cellar Sue Balcom from near Mendan, is that you talk about something everybody likes to talk about, which is food.
It's a great unifier, right?
Yeah. But you make it fun, you make it relatable, and you laugh, of course, which is infectious. We laugh too. Oh. But you also
because somebody told me I sounded like a witch once. You know? Well, Halloween's coming up. I can cackle with the best of them, right?
Well, that's right. Well, actually, and so is fall, and we'll be talking about that, you know. But let's talk about why people should become members, because it's easy to do.
It starts with a simple phone call. You can call 800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. It is our fall membership drive, and when you make an investment, you are helping to provide the funding that makes Main Street possible. Again, it's not very difficult. Just go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
Right, because even if people think that I have this not a radio voice at the moment, they always tell me they learn something each week from what we talk about on Main Street Eats. And I think that's important because right now, in light of what's going on with the pandemic and things are changing, people are really looking towards local foods as a way to kind of come together and provide for their family. And food is good. Food is love where I come from.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're German from Russia heritage, right?
That's right. And there isn't anything better than food when it came to getting together with my family. And I kind of miss that, you know, like we'd have these great big weddings and there would be homemade sausage. And so I really would like to try and kind of carry on some of those traditions with my kids, you know, just just so they don't forget where they came from. Vishik!
Well, tradition is so important in passing down any sort of regional wisdom that you have. And of course, food is just fun. You are investing in that kind of programming when you call 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. Sue, I have just had a ball being on the opposite side of the microphone with you during these segments. I only wish we could do them in person, but there's a bit of a distance thing there going
right.
on. But, you know, speaking of distance, we cover a lot of space in North Dakota. Geographically, this is a large area. We have lots of transmitters. We have towers. You can help everyone in this region have access to all the Sue Balcom you want, or to Tom Ezern, or Matt O'Lean and his great movie reviews. Everything that you enjoy about Main Street, that's available with your investment when you call 800-359-4145 or when you give online at prairiepublic.org.
We are in our fall membership drive, and we just do these things a couple of times a year because, as you know, we're non-commercial. We're public radio. That means we are member-supported, and that means we need members, new members and members to step up to take the place of people whose, you know, COVID-19 problems have been compounded, and they've had to withdraw perhaps some of their support for things like Prairie Public. So pay it forward for somebody else, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a village, and the village is wherever you're hearing this show right now. It is our fall membership drive. It's easy to become a member. It's 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org. And Sue, that's our topic today because autumn begins next week.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And autumn means cooler weather, and you have to stay indoors, so you might as well listen to the radio, and you can find out what's going on all over the United States, and you don't have to wear a mask, so you can drink some good spicy tea and just have a wonderful afternoon. But it's also kind of like, I don't know, this is my favorite time of the year next to the other three seasons. And so I feel sorry for people who don't get to witness autumn. And, you know, we have so few trees in this state that when the trees start turning colors, you know, we're out there just absorbing as much of that as we possibly can. And it's kind of like, just, you know, we plant trees just for the color out there. So after the gardening's all done, we go out and collect leaves and we press them between the pages of a good book. And then when they fall out in the spring, you're like, I wonder what I did that for.
Well, Sue, you've got that root cellar farm. You're growing stuff during the growing season. You go to the market, the farmers markets, and you sell your produce and your finished goods there. So you bring a wealth of information. This season, what would you tell us about autumn for people who grow like you do and sell like you do?
Well, sometimes we get a little depressed because it's like the end of cucumber season, and that means no more pickles, you know.
Well, let's not forget the tomatoes.
Oh, yes. And oh, my gosh, I had the most wonderful tomatoes this year. They were just absolutely gorgeous. And we do market until the end of October because there are things that we can talk about later on that are still out there and they store well. And but right now, yes, I'm just kind of like, I made the last of my salsa, which is famous around here. And I have no more pickles, which are becoming famous. And I'm surprised about that because this is the first year I've ever really done that. But, you know, we have this new high tunnel and we just bought this new walk behind tractor. And so right now we're kind of cleaning out dead foliage and I'm getting ready to plant garlic and we're going to put some compost on the gardens and then dig that in with that new tractor because it's such a cool thing. And I can't wait. I'm already got my little waterproof right as rain notebook and pencil out, and I'm making notes about things we're going to do different next year, and I'm cleaning up tools, and and then we're going to sit down and listen to the radio all winter long next to the fireplace because, oh, you guys, it's autumn, and you'll notice that there are buffalo berry bushes loaded with red berries this year. And that's usually indicative of a very hard winter with lots and lots of snow. Tractor has a snow thrower on it, too. We can't wait to use it.
Well, I could wait if I were you. You know, I used to be a weatherman a long, long, long time ago, very long time ago. And we always used to talk about meteorological fall and astronomical fall. And, of course, if we're talking about fall next week, that's astronomical. We're already in meteorological fall. So, you know, we're just parsing hairs here. But we do that with Sue Balcom.
Right, right. And I'm so impressed because you know about the difference between astronomical and meteorological seasons. Now, I prefer the astronomical ones because my life is kind of astronomical and I'm always watching the moon. And so one day when I was still working the newspaper, I was on my way to town and absolutely, it must have been like 7:30 in the morning. The sun is right behind me. The moon, full moon, was right in front of me and they were like facing each other. Now, the days aren't exact opposite. I mean, they're not like equally parsed that day, but they are so close that it was just kind of a cool thing. Yeah. And then, of course, because we have the high tunnels and the greenhouse and all of these other things on the property, I can tell what season it is by where the sun comes up. Like you can really see how things are changing right now quite quickly. And the leaves on the trees have been around now they started changing like, well, I don't know, about a week ago or so, and they're still hanging on to the trees. And I think that that's kind of a little miracle in itself too, because sometimes we'll get a frost and then boom, they just drop in one day.
No,
like
right?
Gone.
Right.
I know that in Northwest Minnesota, the state publishes a fall color guide to tell you when the trees are going to be peak in various parts of the state. Now, North Dakota, as you mentioned, it's not terribly heavily forested unless you're up in the Turtle Mountain area and Walhalla. Those parts of North Dakota have lots of trees. But we have rivers, and those rivers typically have a fair amount of tree growth around them. So there is color. It's, you know, you might have to go look for it, but it's there. And it's a miracle, isn't it? What happens to these leaves,
right?
The kind of color they create.
I've heard it, and I still never understand what's happening.
Well, I have a sumac bush in the front yard.
They're
that's
gorgeous.
Just really amazing. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh, that thing turns the most gorgeous colors. And it spreads. Like, that was a bonus when I bought this bush from my friend, is that it's one of those deer stag antler sumacs. So when the leaves fall off of it, it looks like antlers. And there are the deer are even changing colors this time of year. Like, I've noticed the deer,
I don't think there's
are like
chlorophyll
dark
breakdown though.
I don't think so either, but they're doing it in conjunction with the trees, so that when the leaves fall off the trees, they stand in the amongst the bottom there's river bottoms, and you can't tell where they are most of the time.
Well, that's because they're getting ready to hide.
Yeah.
right, because you know what comes next. Like, after autumn comes hunting season.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Well, maybe it's like flamingos that are actually white, but they turn pink because of what they eat. Maybe as leaves. I have no idea.
I really want some flamingos in my yard.
There are people who can arrange that, Sue. I think Bismarck probably has them.
That'd be so cool. But, you know, leaves are green because of the chlorophyll in there. And that's kind of like their little feeding system between the roots and the leaves. That's why when in the wintertime, if you don't protect your trees from the mice that get under there when the snow is really deep and they'll girdle your tree, that breaks that connection between the roots and the leaves and they will die. So you have to we really cherish our trees out here because we have so few of them. But that chlorophyll, there's something else in the leaves that causes the red color. And of course, your maples, and I can't pronounce that word. I think it starts with an A, but your maple trees.
Anthocyanin or something.
That's what it is. And that creates that red color. But it also is determined by, you know, how hard the freeze is, what the temperatures are like after the freeze, and how much rainfall we get. Sometimes when those trees are nourished a little bit more in the summertime, they actually hang on to those leaves a little bit longer. But when they're ready to go, and I don't know how they know when they're ready to go, but they will start forming a barrier between the branch and the leaf. They're just like, I'm cutting you off, baby. Go away. And so they grow those cells and those leaves fall off. And if you're fortunate enough to have a day after a hard freeze when there's no wind, I've sat outside under a tree and you can hear them letting go. They're just like, boop, and they float to the ground. And it's an ethereal, spiritual thing, the changing of the seasons. And it's something I just love and I've always been interested in my whole life.
Well, when I was a kid, of course, in the summer, you'd be looking for the four-leaf clover, the perfect clover.
I'm looking over a four-leaf clover.
You said you wouldn't sing.
I know I managed to get it in there, though, aren't I?
But in the fall, you can sit out there, and especially if you're in an area that has a lot of maple leaves, you can look for the perfect maple leaf.
Yeah.
And because they last forever, you know, they really do.
Yes. Like I said, you'll find them falling out of my books, all of my books, when you're like, oh, here, borrow this book. Why are there leaves in this book?
I love it. So,
because we try to remember, you know, we're remembering the colors and and it's just fun. And it's fun to talk about these things, too, you know.
I want to go back to what you said about buffalo berry bushes. You said being thick with fruit can indicate potential for a hard winter. Do you know the science behind that?
There is no science. It's Native American folklore. And I actually have some wonderful people that come up from Standing Rock to the farmer's market. And I verified that with them the other day. There was a young man wanting to know about salsa. And so we got into this conversation. He's like, don't you make buffalo berry jam? And I'm like, it's so hard to pick them, but there's so many of them and they are delicious. And he said, yeah, that's indicative of a harsh winter. And I haven't double checked with the almanac. Have you, Doug? Do you ever go to the old Farmer's Almanac?
I haven't in almost most of my lifetime now.
just been because putting it off for 37 years myself.
I'm recalling when I was a weatherman, the people who would call up and say, have you read the almanac today? Because that does not match the forecast. And I have to get back to them and say, you know, the almanac should be sold in the fiction section of the bookstore.
See, I'm on their side here. I'm like, if you watch the mourning doves, they're paired up now and they don't get further than 1 foot apart from their mate. They're out there in the yard and they're close together. The deer have already changed color, like I mentioned earlier. The animals are getting ready for winter. And so we need to get ready for winter too.
Well,
because it's coming.
I'm putting on my winter weight. I'm way ahead of you, Sue.
Well, part of getting ready for winter is, saving for the next season. And of course, that gets us back to our other theme of the day, which is membership. This is your opportunity to help us, you know, store a little for the next season, you know, when we don't have a membership drive, when we have to sustain ourselves because the people who are listening have decided to become members, or those people who are members have decided to up their membership, or perhaps even become sustaining members, which makes it easier for them and everybody else. It's easy to do. 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
Sustaining membership would be like the squirrels putting all the nuts in their cheeks, and then you have enough
and
nuts
and running to
all
hide
winter
in the bushes there.
So you know you have the fund.
That image is in my head now.
Right, but you guys, it's like the grasshopper and the ant too. You know, like you know that story where the ant is busy working,
and the grasshopper is fiddling away.
Yeah, because he's lazy all summer. But you forgot to mention also people who contribute, and they can contribute with credit cards or checks or whatever, as low as $15 a month, but don't they get like something as a bonus if they actually
a
sign up?
Face something mask
that just, yes!
With our Prairie Public logo on it. Is there anything more indicative of 2020 and
right.
COVID-19 than the face mask? The story of the year.
The face mask should be the person of the year.
Yeah.
Whatever does that. Time magazine, I think. The face
that's
mask.
That's hilarious. Because, you know, now everybody is sporting, you know, they have different symbols on them. They're making different statements with their
yeah.
face masks.
It's,
you know,
it's the new bumper sticker.
It is. And then you can hang it on your rearview mirror like dice back in the 50s. And then people will say, oh, look, they have their face mask with them. They're cool people. And they listen to Prairie Public because I think I see that little swoosh on there.
Yeah. And that face mask is available to a member at any level when you call 800-359-4145. You can also go online to prairiepublic.org. Every dollar matters, and your gift goes directly into funding the shows that you like.
There's another benefit, too, because if you, you know, come in at $15 a month as your contribution, which is, you know, not that much, it's a few coffees, you can get a digital subscription to
yeah.
the Washington Post for a year.
Oh.
Let me tell you, I have that. It is wonderful. I have the New York Times as well. These digital subscriptions are incredible because these sources of information allow you to really drill down deeply and get a lot of good stuff that, you know, makes your day a little more informed.
Right.
And they just come right to your inbox on your computer, so you never miss anything when you have a digital subscription to Washington Post. Like, I love that.
Well, 800-359-4145 gets you to us and helps you restore your membership or start your membership or increase your membership or go online to prairiepublic.org. It only takes a moment. Dakota Datebook is next.
What's it like to live in the woods alone, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years, or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest hole for over 2,000 miles? Hey, North Dakota, I'm Glenn Washington. Experience amazing stories from the people who live them on Snap Judgment. Join me every Saturday in Prairie Public for Snap. Snap Judgment airs Saturday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Mountain on Prairie Public.
Then at 6 p.m. Central, it's LiveWire with me, your host, Luke Burbank. Each week on our show, we talk to all kinds of folks, writers, actors, artists, comedians. Plus, we've got live music, and we even like to hear from you. Yes, you, the Prairie Public listener. You're going to have your chance to chime in as well. It's all the fun of a live event. Remember those? Those were awesome. All from the safety and comfort of your radio. Don't miss LiveWire, Saturday nights at 6 Central following Snap Judgment on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 17th. On this date, in 1944, Operation Market Garden began. Market Garden was a massive airborne assault on German-occupied Holland during World War II. Over 1,000 C-47s delivered parachute troops to the landing areas. One of the C-47 pilots was Murray Lawler, who was born in a sod house west of Temvick, North Dakota in 1921. On September 17, 1944, Lawler's C-47 delivered troops of the 82nd Airborne Division to a jump site near Grosbeak, Holland, and the next day towed Waco gliders filled with supplies to the same area. The 82nd Airborne succeeded in securing their objectives, but other forces failed to secure a bridgehead over the Rhine River, part of a planned Allied invasion route into northern Germany. Consequently, the main objective of Market Garden was lost. Lawler's missions during the war also included the delivery of troops and supplies for the Normandy D-Day invasion, the landings in southern France called Operation Dragoon, the Battle of the Bulge, and ultimately the battle to cross the Rhine River. While stationed in England, Murray met and eventually married Miss Margaret Bradbury of Nottingham. Lawler had wondered if Margaret had any royalty in her background. Margaret assured Murray that she was just a commoner with no royal blood. Murray said, "That may be true, but you will be my Duchess of Dakota." Lawler was so taken with the title of his new bride that he had it painted on the side of his aircraft. Murray and Margaret were married in England, and after the war was over, Margaret was the first war bride to arrive in North Dakota, where she was interviewed by the Bismarck Tribune after her arrival by train. Mr. and Mrs. Lawler settled on a farm in Emmons County and raised 9 children. Murray passed away in 2006, and Margaret in 2017. The original C-47, Duchess of Dakota, was destroyed after the war, but in 2004, a C-47 was bought and restored by Bob Odegaard of Kindred, North Dakota. In honor of Murray and Margaret, the plane was painted like the original Duchess of Dakota and is now on display at the Dakota Territory Air Museum in Minot. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Scott Nelson. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Next time on The Pulse, friends seem more important than ever in these tough times, even if we can't physically be around them.
I had a Zoom video conference with 6 of my college friends talking about our anxieties.
And researchers are learning more about just how important friendship is.
It actually helps you live longer.
How friends affect our well-being.
Coming up next, here on Prairie Public.
Just a couple minutes left in Main Street today to remind you that we are member-supported Prairie Public, and we are looking for members in our fall membership drive. It's easy to do that, it's convenient, and it helps everybody, including you, because you're listening to something that people are paying for. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, or go online to prairiepublic.org.
You know, it's funny that you say that. You're listening to something that people pay for, because it's absolutely here because of the people who came before you. This programming is possible because of everyone who stood up and said, I will make it possible for the next generation of informed electorate here to have access to this information. And so do it for yourself and do it for the next generation of listeners. You are a better informed citizen when you listen to Prairie Public. And any amount makes you a member. That's the beauty of public radio. And it all starts with your financial investment in whatever amount is comfortable to your budget. A couple ways to do that: go to prairiepublic.org or give us a call at 800-359-4145 and choose an amount that works for you.
Friday on our show, we'll meet Jonah Lanto of the Good Talk podcast in Minot. It's in its second season. It strives to provide new perspectives and new ways of thinking, and they don't mind a little humor along the way. Also, Dave Thompson will join us for our usual Friday discussion of the week's big stories, and Matt Olean will review another new movie, The New Mutants. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.